Hello, Blenders. On this week's episode, we are going to be talking about huge shifts in the 2020 theatrical calendar. We're going to break down the 355 trailer and talk about Jamie Foxx back in the Spider-Man Spider-Verse.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 138 of Real Blend, a podcast that has been delayed until June 2nd, 2023. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend, back with another rousing episode of your favorite movie podcast. On this week's show, we're going to be discussing huge, huge shifts to the 2020 and also 2021 theatrical calendar. We're going to break down the trailer for a new film called The 355, and we're going to get into Jamie Foxx returning to the Spider-Verse in a really weird way. But before we get into all of that, let me introduce the boys, starting with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey.
You promised that this is going to be a rousing episode. You don't know that.
It could
suck all to hell.
No. I'm basing it on previous episodes and knowing that eventually we ramp up to the place where we are rousing.
We rouse.
By definition. Yes. Yeah.
Well, this largely is also the episode that Sean's going to finally admit that Hubie Halloween is his number one of this year and last year.
That would be rousing. That would rouse me.
I laughed really hard.
Me too. Me too. I'm not going to lie. It made me laugh. I'm sorry.
That's Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Sean, Jake, Gabe, good to see you guys.
There's a moment in Hubie Halloween, especially very early on, when I knew that, like, this is Kevin McCarthy's jam.
I mean, it has everything.
And
that
it involved a fart joke?
Yeah, it was a fart joke.
There was a fart joke. I mean, it's no surprise. I am a fan of potty humor. I have no problem admitting that. Yeah. You know, it's really funny because I put this in my tweet earlier this week, but back in the day, I used to listen to Adam Sandler's albums growing up, and he used to release these comedy albums, and there was a bit on there called The Hypnotist. I think I said this to you, Sean, at some point.
Yeah.
With Kevin Nealon, and it's like fart jokes the entire time. It's very funny. And then you watch Hubie Halloween, which is what, 25 something years later?
Yes.
Same type of jokes.
Yes.
You know, for some people, fart jokes work for your life.
But he's,
man,
53. That's the point, okay, is that he's 53. I would like to see him evolve.
Hey, Uncut Gems was a pretty evolved part.
And didn't he make a promise that, like, if I don't get an Oscar nomination for Uncut Gems, I'm going to make a really bad movie? Like, is this it?
No, I don't think this is it.
No.
I think the worst one is actually still to come, because this one's got some really good jokes in it. All right, housekeeping. Yeah. If you are currently looking at our beautiful smiling faces, that means you are watching on YouTube, and we thank you very much. If you're listening to us, please head over to YouTube. We have two channels we would like for you guys to subscribe to. Search Real Blend on YouTube or search Real Blend Clips. One does the full show. One is doing shows or clips that we're pulling out for things that we want to be able to share, interview clips, segments that we find really appealing. And then you guys can subscribe and turn on your notifications and know every single time a new one of those are put up. Of course, you can also find the show in its entirety, any place that you download podcasts. And we want to send you guys to the Real Blend store, cinemablend.com/shop. You can get t-shirts and mugs and some other swag that have the show's emblems all over them. Later in the show, I'm going to plug the premium episode because those are a lot of fun. Like, those have been going really well. We're having a lot of fun doing those, and we're getting a really great response from people who are subscribed to that. So I'll give another plug for the premium episode later on. That brings us to the weekly poll. And because for October, the show is staying very heavily into the horror genre, as you'll see later on in our blend game, and the fact that Kevin's wearing a Jaws t-shirt, is we asked the question, who is telling the scariest horror stories these days? Now, in the text chain, when we tried to figure out which names we should put on here, we legitimately had 6 or 7 names of people that could have been included.
So Blumhouse was a good one, by the way. I know there was debate about that, but
yes.
The issue with Blumhouse is he encapsulates so many filmmakers that are telling great stories. He's kind of a cheat code.
To Gabe's point, if you said Blumhouse and Jordan Peele in the same tweet, both of them were involved in Get Out, how would you differentiate? Yeah. Okay.
Here's who we went with. And Kevin, I'm going to defer to you here for this one. You get to choose who you think people went with. We went with James Wan, Jordan Peele, Mike Flanagan, or other.
And this is current day, who they think is telling the best horror stories.
Correct. Who is telling the scariest horror stories these days? James Wan, Jordan Peele, Mike Flanagan, or other.
I know this is a stupid question to ask now because the poll's done, but did Flanagan encapsulate Hill House as well?
It's not just
movies. We're talking about TV shows too?
I think so. Yeah. Because even when I thought Jordan Peele, I included his... Well, he hasn't done any Twilight Zone episodes yet, has he?
Well, he introduced some of the first season. Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's funny because I want to go... I would personally say Jordan Peele, but I think our audience chose Flanagan.
You're exactly right. They chose Mike Flanagan with 38% and Jordan Peele got 30%, which I think is a slight at James Wan. I know that he branched off and did an Aquaman film, but his Conjuring films are... really scary.
I think he just hasn't made one in a while. I think it's like, you know, out of sight, out of mind. I think it's just because he hasn't, like, his name hasn't been up front with the horror genre within the past few years. He's kind of been forgotten about, but like isn't as necessarily thought of.
I can see
that. I mean, Aquaman was a horror movie. You guys remember that beach scene with the Pitbull song as he pulled up into the ocean? I mean,
no, but you remember he did the trench sequence in that, and that actually was a scary moment in that film.
Are you talking about that cool art shot? Where he dives
and all the creatures follow after him. James Wan's made some incredible horror films. So stop sleeping on James Wan. Gabe, you said there was an other that was a huge omission. Someone we left out.
Ari Aster.
I heard a lot of Ari Aster.
It's a great other.
When you guys were texting about that, I looked up Aster and I was like thinking to myself, I'm like, all right, it's so weird to say his name without Ari before it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about Aster here. No, it is. It's weird. Like, some directors, you can just say, oh, yeah, Peele or Spielberg. Aster doesn't sound good by itself. I guess technically Gabe has a good point, because if Jordan Peele can be up for it with Us and Get Out, why couldn't Ari Aster be up for it with Hereditary and Midsommar?
See, Hereditary is a horror movie to me. Midsommar...
Oh, come on.
Horror?
Don't be that. Don't be that guy. It's a
is
horror
Midsommar
movie.
Midsommar horror.
Yes.
I think it's more psychological thriller.
Thank you.
That's such a cop out to get out of the horror. It is a horror film.
It's a horror movie.
What's Silence of the Lambs?
A horror film.
See, I don't consider
it can be
the
both.
Lambs
it doesn't have
film.
To be not
it
a
can
psychological
be both,
thriller.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is this thing that happens, and I'm not saying that you guys do it, but I feel like whenever a horror film starts like elevating and like becomes like more prestigious, then people want to take it out of the horror genre and call it something else.
But
like,
I think
like,
Get Out.
Like, no, like it is. Get Out is a horror film.
Get Out is a horror movie, but I also feel like it could fall. I just feel like Silence of the Lambs.
Specifically, I feel like with the horror genre, anytime it's like it starts getting like critical acclaim and like more like universally accepted, then critics want to like pull it out of the horror. It's like, no, like a horror film can be a prestige film too.
I'll give you a good example of a horror film that elevates that still says it still stays horror. I don't think turns into psychological thriller. Scream, Cabin in the Woods.
Sure.
I think those are just straight up horror films that do actually elevate and are better than whatever you're referring to. The idea of like a general standard horror film. But it's an interesting point. I mean, psychological thriller. It's so funny because like Silence of the Lambs, I would never categorize as horror. I just wouldn't.
Horror films make me scared. I don't think that Midsommar ever made me scared.
I think that's an oversimplification. Because scared is subjective. Like I can think a comedy is good. Like and I mean, like if Dumb and Dumber doesn't make me laugh, it doesn't change the fact that it's still a comedy. Like a horror film, whether it scares you or not, like it's still a horror film.
Okay.
What is a horror film? Sounds like a great bonus episode, guy, or premium episode.
Yeah,
like,
did it.
I do think genres are very interesting to play with. I mean, like theoretically, Get Out could be a psychological thriller, and it's so funny. I probably described it that way to people at some point. I'm sure I said Get Out deals with psychological elements and it's a thriller, but yeah, it's so interesting. How I guess we somehow define horror in our own way. Like I said, I would not categorize Silence of the Lambs as horror. I just wouldn't.
What is The Lighthouse?
It's not a horror film.
It's not horrifying. A horror.
Why not?
I don't think it was made as a horror film.
But it scared me.
I don't think the director. Well, there are a lot of movies I see that scare me that aren't horror films.
True.
Wow.
This is an interesting question.
Maybe we'll revisit this.
Yeah, I don't think the director of The Lighthouse would call that movie a horror film.
Would Ari Aster call Midsommar a horror movie?
We talked about that in the interview.
That was one of my questions to him.
Yeah, that was one of my questions, is this idea of people taking films out of the horror genre. Thanks for remembering.
I remember, Jake. It was a great question. Jake, we had to talk to a lot of other filmmakers between now and then.
Weirdly enough, I remember where I was during that interview. I was at Lauren's dad's house and stealing his neighbor's Wi-Fi to complete that interview on Lauren's childhood bed.
I was over there.
I
was on the other side of the room for some reason.
I remember where I was. Yeah.
All right, let's move off of this. This is normally when we would throw it to an interview, but this week it's just all of us together, so we have plenty of news to get to, including the calendar shifts that have been decimating our industry. And so I'm going to really quick go through.
I'm so tired of this topic.
Yeah, good. Join the club, my friend. But it's big news, and I feel like we have to cover it, because a number of big movies have moved not just out of 2020, but are shifting around to 2021. The big one that dropped first and foremost was Dune. Dune moved out of December, kind of like how we predicted it was going to. Once Wonder Woman landed in December, and Wonder Woman and Dune are both Warner Brothers films, we knew one of them was going to budge and that Dune probably was going to move back. I didn't anticipate how far back it was going to move. It moves back a full calendar year from now. So it's going to open on October 1st, 2021, theoretically. That date...
Which movie?
Already,
Dune?
Dune is October 1st.
I thought it was October 21st.
Was it the first?
Am I wrong? I thought it was 21st.
Well, I know it's October 2021.
It's okay. October 2021.
Could that be where you got the 21st from?
My bad.
That was the date that The Batman was supposed to open, and that is also a Warner Brothers movie, so then we anticipated that one going to move, and of course it did move to March of 2022. In addition to The Batman getting moved, DC and Warner Brothers moved all of their films back, including The Flash and Shazam 2, and now The Rock's Black Adam film, which currently has no date because who knows when it's coming. And all those other films, The Flash and Shazam 2, they took dates in 2023. It's a constant shuffle of moving things back. I think Bond moved since last we talked. We didn't even really discuss the fact that film has been moved back into next year. So here are the movies that are still on the schedule for this year. The Croods, A New Age is going to be opening. Pixar still saying that Soul is going to open. Death on the Nile remains on the calendar. And then this big blockbuster, Wonder Woman 1984, is still currently down for Christmas Day. Those are the only major releases still scheduled for 2020. And the reason why, I know Jake looks skeptical, but we're going to get into some of the reasons why we think that this might happen, because Regal has shut down or is about to shut down. Cineworld, the parent company that owns them, is about to shut down. However, AMC Theaters has said that they are going to stay open in places that they can and be ready to play some of these films that are going to be coming out, and also some of the films that have these day and date or close to day and date streamings, like David Fincher's film Mank, which Netflix has said they want to run in theaters in November and then bring to their streaming service shortly after that, probably in December for awards time. So I don't know, guys, what do you think about the new normal where a few movies still have release dates holding on for the rest of the year and a few other films are going to play around with partial theatrical release, partial streaming.
I feel like we discussed a lot on this show something that I have a question about specifically. We discussed a lot about what films were moving to streaming, which ones were just being delayed in general, right? And we kind of came up with this idea of like, okay, let's look at the films they're moving and look at the films they're putting onto VOD. Mm-hmm. Trolls mm-hmm. World Tour or Scoob. Yeah, films that might not necessarily, you know, they would be great in theaters, but they'll still do well at home. So this week, and we're going to get into this in the week with movies later on with The War with Grandpa, that's one that I'm baffled by. Why would that not just go to VOD? Like, they're releasing that in select theaters this weekend. That feels like, I'll tell you what happened. I was on the air the other day. I was airing my interview with Robert De Niro and the kids from the film, and my anchor looked at me and goes, hey, can I watch this in my home this weekend? I said, no, it's in select theaters. And he's like, oh man. Like, I was like, that right there, they just lost whatever money that would be. And yeah. I guess my point is, War with Grandpa feels like a kind of movie that would fit into the same elements as like a Trolls or a Scoob. So do you think is it a legal thing, or do you think they're just I'm gonna see what happens, because no Regals open this weekend in the United States, just the AMCs and whatever other theater chains are open, but no one's going. Tenet made less than $50 million in the U.S. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what the decision makers behind them are, because even when you look at a studio like Disney. Disney will hold off on a Marvel project or say that Soul is going to go to theaters, but they're content to put Mulan behind a paywall or let Artemis Fowl go to their streaming service. So I can't even figure out internally at the different studios who's making what decisions and why. Warner Brothers is going to send Zemeckis' film The Witches to paid VOD, but they're content to move Dune, and they're content to keep Wonder Woman as a theatrical.
They're making choices.
I wonder
how
much of that is being driven by the directors, if the directors have much say in it. If Patty Jenkins and Denis Villeneuve are saying 100%, like, hey, we want theaters and we'll wait as long as we need to. But Zemeckis may say, I'm okay with streaming. It's possible that the directors are the ones kind of having some sway in it, because it does. You're right. Looking at the decisions by stepping back and figuring out who's moving what to where doesn't make a lot of sense.
There's no through line. There's no like sort of
zero
example that we can look at and go, this is what everyone is doing.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
Who's the studio for War with Grandpa?
It's called 101 Studios. And to me, I feel like they could have had a major cash grab this weekend.
Yeah. Sure.
Because, you know, I mean, yes, you have a bunch of things hitting Netflix. You have Hubie Halloween. We'll get into all that with the weekend movies. But I feel like that's a perfect movie for families. And I feel like they're going to miss out on millions.
And hasn't it been sort of a weird path for that movie to be like, wasn't it shot? It was like shot 3 years ago under the Weinstein umbrella. And then all the stuff with Weinstein was going on. So it ended up being delayed. In fact, it was kind of strange. I don't know if you were sort of taken aback, Kevin. We saw the movie in order to do the interviews, and then we like the kids popped up on my screen and I was like, oh, you guys got old.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until afterward that I realized that it's been like 3-4 years since they actually filmed, because it was supposed to come out 3 years ago, which means they filmed it probably 3.5-4 years ago. So I was expecting a certain looking kid to pop up on my screen, and when he popped up, I was like, hey, he had a beard. It was a whole thing.
War ages you, Jake.
Apparently.
The War with Grandpa. Breaking news from our interviews in Cinema Blend about War with Grandpa. Robert De Niro has not seen Joe Pesci's Home Alone.
Wow. All right, now that's
pretty good. De Niro.
Am I surprised by that? Do you think De Niro watches movies? He's probably not a movie guy.
I don't know.
Do you think De Niro's a movie guy?
I think he watches certain movies. I think if Scorsese puts a movie out, he'll watch it, even if he's not in it.
But not seeing Home Alone, that's like... First of all, he's friends with Joe Pesci.
Right.
Home Alone is classic. It's
Wouldn't
like an iconic.
You want to see Pesci in it? I'd want to see Pesci in it if I was friends
with
him. Pesci, I promise you, Pesci is not watching War with Grandpa.
Well, why would he? But Home Alone is great. Home Alone is. I mean, like that's the thing.
Home Alone 2.
I love Home Alone 2.
I love Home Alone 2.
Dude, the shower scene in Home Alone 2 when he like I still think one of the coolest pieces of movie trivia ever are those fake movies within Home Alone.
I always thought those were real.
Me too, for the longest time, because they're based on like old, like I think like James Cagney films or whatever, but like they're one's called Angels with Filthy Souls, the other one's called Angels with Even Filthier Souls. That's the second one. And they shot... And I find it so amazing that they actually went out and shot those.
Wait, does he use, because I haven't seen Lost in New York. Is he used the
You've
same
never
bit?
Seen Lost in New York?
If I did, one. I saw it as a kid. So he does it on the TV to fool people again?
Yeah, in a hotel. In the Plaza sequel. Hotel.
Okay. It's called the
7593000. Yeah. I don't know why I
Angels
remember the
phone
number.
Even filthier souls.
You know, the McAllister house is just like right down the road.
That's right.
Not the Burbs.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. Is it the same house that they use for Uncle Buck? No, not Uncle Buck. For Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
I don't know. It would make sense. Well, because John Hughes did all the stuff around. Like the high school from Breakfast Club is down the road. Both houses from Ferris Bueller are here.
I told you guys I showed PJ Breakfast Club and it bombed, right? Did I mention that?
Maybe. Oh. How old is he?
16.
Maybe he needs to be like more. I don't know. That's high school. I was about to say, maybe he needs wheelhouse. To. Yeah, I feel like that's. That should be relatable.
I have a confession. I like Breakfast Club. I don't love Breakfast Club. I like Breakfast Club. By the way, I'm only going to take this opportunity because you mentioned the movie. We need to just celebrate one day on this show that Uncle Buck is a masterpiece.
That's great.
That movie is brilliant. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. We've done John Hughes.
Remember the big pancake? And then the drill bit?
So all right, good. So we kind of touched on this about Cineworld closing and Regal movie theaters in general for the foreseeable future closing. I find it strange that they are closing because they theoretically are saying there's not any product to show, so we can't keep our employees here. It doesn't make sense financially to keep our employees here because people aren't really responding to the retro programming. But then AMC and Cinemark are okay with staying open. I thought that was odd that those two are going against each other. There is one thing that Cinemark is doing that I find really interesting, which is bringing Alita Battle Angel back to theaters, and they are almost like listening to the fan base that is pushing really hard to get that re-released in theaters, and I would like to see them get a chance to show how strong that fan base is and maybe get a sequel made. So
why not delay the re-release till theaters are back to some type of normalcy? Like, I feel like, is anyone gonna go?
Well, I think that if you program in something like that that's super unique,
they'll go.
Like, let's say that Tarantino used this ability to do a wide-ish release for the whole Bloody Affair. Like, wouldn't you go? You'd go, yeah. Right? Because that's something that you don't get to see on the big screen that often.
Well, also, Cinemark is doing something that I wish AMC were doing, because I'm surrounded by AMC theaters, but not Cinemark. Cinemark, for like $100, will let you rent out a theater to yourself.
Yes.
Like, that's not bad. I would do that. Like, I think it depends. I think it's like $150 for if you want it for Tenet, it's like $150. If you want it for Empire Strikes Back, it's $100. I would pay $100 and go sit in a theater by myself and watch Empire Strikes Back.
Sorry, go ahead, Jake. Go ahead.
No, I wish more theaters would do that. And also, like, publicize it. Like, publicize the fact that, like, for $100, you can have an entire theater.
So wait,
to yourself.
On. You could get the entire theater, but then could you invite as many?
Yeah.
People
oh yeah.
As you
can invite. You can invite, like, for, you know.
I think there's
up
limits
to a certain,
like,
extent.
Like,
I'm sure. Yeah. Right.
I'm sure you have to abide by.
Yeah, but I think you have to, like, for example, I know a guy who runs two movie theaters in Fairfax, Virginia. One of them, I'll give him a shout out. He's awesome. University Mall Theaters and Cinema Arts Theaters were two theaters I used to go to in college all the time. They're next to George Mason University. And he emailed me the other day that he's renting out his theaters for $100, and I believe you can bring like 15 people, up to 15 people. So you just divide that by 15 with your friends, and they have concessions. And he's running, like, he has Trial of the Chicago 7 at Cinema Arts right now. And now I don't know if I have to double check if the theater rental is for Cinema Arts. It might just be for University Mall Theaters, but either way, check out him if you live in our area, because he's doing, like, you can, like, bring your whole family to a movie, basically.
That's,
and, like,
pretty cool.
And then no one else is in there, and you get your concessions and things like that. But, you know, I'm really happy that Netflix is still pushing stuff theatrically a little bit, you know, even if, like, I would love to seek Mank out in a theater.
Yes.
I would love to see Mank on the big screen, but you know,
certain filmmakers, I think, warrant it. And we have films by them coming. Paul Greengrass has that Tom Hanks movie that I know I'm going to want to see on a bigger screen. Mank, like you mentioned, obviously. There was one other one too that I knew for sure I would want to see later. Oh, Clooney's movie, the science fiction film that he wants, that he's,
I just got the book to read
later in the year. Nice. See, so
Jake, what's the
things
Jake,
coming.
What's the deal on the Greengrass movie? I didn't see the trailer for it yet.
Was
that later on? Okay, sorry.
Yeah,
my apologies.
Oh, News of the World trailer. Oh, there was a trailer? Shoot.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Why do you think I was texting you guys about it?
I thought that they just showed a photo, like an image.
No, there was a trailer. I didn't watch it yet.
I clicked the link. All right, let's talk about Jamie Foxx in Spider-Man 3 really fast. I have a lot of theories about this, but I want to ask you guys this first and foremost. Do you find it really puzzling that the Marvel Cinematic Universe third Spider-Man movie is bringing back an actor from the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies to play the same character.
If that's that's a giant waving flag. I don't think he's going to be the only person from the movie, from the other Spider-Man films to show up.
Okay.
I think
Andrew Garfield would show up?
I think they're going to strongly start hinting. And also, aren't we getting Doctor Strange first?
No, this will come first.
We're getting Spider-Man first.
Yes. WandaVision WandaVision is going to open up the door to the multiverse.
Okay.
Wanda is going to show up in Doctor Strange, but part of this Marvel shuffle has now moved Doctor Strange back behind Spider-Man.
I think Jamie Foxx is going to have to show up.
Yes.
And when he sees Tom Holland, he's going to have to make some kind of a comment about like, wait, are you a new Spider-Man? Like, wait, you're not Spider-Man. You're not something has to happen. Like, this is maybe going to break open the possibility of like, wait, like you're not Spider-Man. You're not the guy I fought.
Yeah.
Sean, stupid question for you. Into the Spider-Verse obviously had nothing. It doesn't play into the MCU, but that was a big introduction of the multiverse specifically in that aspect. So I it's such an interesting thing that those two films couldn't be somehow.
I was going to say, I'm curious to find out how much of an influence the success of that movie had on them being open to doing this kind of stuff. Because I think that because that's such a beloved movie and people just understood like there are different Spider-Men and I'm familiar with all of this and it completletely worked. I wouldn't be surprised if we find out years down the line, they're like, oh, when that worked, we were like, oh, we can do this crazy idea.
Feel like, yes, like it worked within our bubble. And I feel like within our film bubble, like it really introduced a lot of us to the multiverse. I still find that the average moviegoer out there, the people that watch our morning shows, Kevin, we still are going to have to explain to them the concept of the multiverse. And we're going to have to explain to them the whole idea of, because like, keep in mind, like Spider-Verse did well, but it didn't do astronomically well. Like in the same way that it took a while for the MCU to pan out, it's going to take a while for people to be able to wrap their brains around this whole, you know.
But the CW DC shows have now done it by bleeding over their Flash, Arrow.
But even those shows don't do well. And I'm still 100%. Having people come to me about like, wait, I don't understand how Michael Keaton's coming back. I'm still having, you know, like Kevin, you talk about your anchors. I have like producers writing me like, wait, like it's Ben Affleck and Michael Keaton. Like what is it? And so like, I still like as excited as we all are because like it's in our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
I still think it's going to be a slow and steady process because, you know, you've got to make sure the average person at home understands why all these people are in the same movie.
So here's my theory. Then this is how I think that they can get to it. I think you can introduce Electro in this third Spider-Man movie, proving that there is now a transition from the Andrew Garfield world into the Tom Holland world, so that when they build to a Sinister Six movie, that is the threat that warrants the need for the three Spider-Men to come together. Like,
wait, so who's all in the Sinister Six? We know it's Keaton.
Well, you would have Keaton. You would have Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, Jared Leto.
You would have Jared Leto as Morbius. You could bring in Michael Mando, who's been teased as the Scorpion. He was in Homecoming.
Okay.
You could have Jamie Foxx as Mysterio, and you could bring over Tom Hardy as Venom.
Jamie Foxx as Electro.
As Electro, yeah.
Yeah.
But haven't they kind of been playing Tom Hardy as like the hero, though? Like, was it like that was one of my knocks against Venom? Is it like he wasn't the bad guy? Dude, is there Venom, any chance they would bring back Willem Dafoe as Green Goblin?
There's a chance for sure. I would rather
he died, though.
He did. I'd rather have them bring back Alfred Molina as Dr. Octopus, truthfully.
Oh, he was great.
Which is surprising because you don't love that movie. That's my favorite Spider-Man film next to Far From Home. And I love Alfred Molina in that movie.
I like it a lot. I think it made a couple of changes to his origin that bother me. But yeah. I'd rather see him come back than Thomas Hayden Church as a Sandman.
Damn it, Sean. Why did you put that idea in my head? Because now if that's not what happens, I'm going to be so... Because that's such a great idea.
It's a $1 billion idea. It's a billion dollar idea. That if you're building up your Sonyverse, and you introduce a Sinister Six, it's such an intimidating threat that they have to use the multiverse.
So is the Sinister Six movie the movie that brings all three Spider-Men together, or is there a Sinister Six movie and then another movie with the three Spider-Men.
No, I would assume that would be the one that brings them all.
Oh, I want this.
That's what I'm
not going to lie to you. Jacob's talking about like we're in this film bubble. I'm confused by this stuff. Like this stuff confuses me. I honestly, there's so much. And I think like it's going to be they're going to have to really hammer it into audiences. Like Jake was saying, Jake, just I want to bring this up real quick because you asked Tom Holland about this at the Far From Home junket. And what did he say?
At first he it was funny because it was almost as if at least the other two people in the room, because as we've talked about often, Zendaya was also in the room as well as Jacob Batalon. And when I asked the question, he's there. It was a weird angle. Jacob Batalon and Zendaya both sort of perked up and going like, oh, wow, that's cool. Like almost as if like they hadn't really thought about it or it hadn't been brought up. And they were both like, oh, that's cool. That's really cool. That's awesome. Like, could we do that? Would we want to do that? Yeah. And Tom Holland just sort of sat there.
He was very quiet.
He was very quiet. And then they both kind of like looked at him. And then they started dying laughing as if like he knew something. And then he kind of started trying to give like this generic junket answer that didn't play to the question. And then he kind of paused and goes, no, like, of course, it would be awesome if we could get all the guys in a movie like that would be, you know. But there was definitely it was interesting that the two of them, Zendaya and Jacob, their initial reaction was like, oh, I hadn't even thought about that. That sounds cool. And Tom just was very silent in how he goes. You know, Tom obviously has the reputation of spoiling stuff, and it maybe I'm overthinking it, but I don't know if you guys have seen the video. It really seemed like he was holding something back.
I watched it recently, and I noticed how quiet he was being, which makes me think, like, I can't imagine how often you are around the Marvel offices, and I think John Watts told us this when we were having our spoiler conversation with him, where he's just like, every room you look into, someone's working on an anticipated project, that there aren't meetings where they say to Tom Holland, yeah, and then eventually we'll just get to a point where we can build up to a Sinister Six and maybe we'll bring in Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire. Yeah. And he has to sit on that, you know, and not reveal it in any way, shape, or form. Whereas I'd be grabbing everybody I could find and being like, guess what they're going to do? Yeah. You have no idea. Yeah. They're talking about this.
Sean, correct me if I'm wrong on this. Yeah. So we did a podcast interview with John Watts, as Sean just mentioned. If you want to find it, you can search for it. It was actually really cool. We were in London with him. What did he say again about whether or not the J.K. Simmons' character was not the same J. Jonah Jameson from the Tobey Maguire films? I was confused by that.
Correct. He said it's not the same version. It's a J. Jonah Jameson. And just simply when they wanted to recast that character, he's so ingrained as J. Jonah Jameson that they had to use him, which is why I don't think, like, when you cast Jamie Foxx as Electro, he doesn't have the same married to the role the way J.K. Simmons does. No. Like, if you say, I'm going to bring back J. Jonah Jameson, everyone's like, oh my God, you have to get J.K. Simmons or don't bother. But then the minute you say, I'm going to bring over Electro, you can say, like, well, anyone can play Electro. It's not like Jamie Foxx put such a stamp on it. So,
yeah.
I would also flag that as one of those Marvel quotes that they say, and then when you find out there's a multiverse and that J. Jonah Jameson is actually just looks like that in two different universes or whatever, like, I could see that coming back.
Because also keep in mind, didn't he have hair in Far From Home, and he was, or no, he had hair in the Maguire, he had hair in the Maguire. Yeah. Like, dude, how great would that be if Tobey Maguire in the new, like, multiverse Spider-Man sees the bald J. Jonah Jameson and just gets to have just a fun, like, oh, you're bald in this one.
Yeah, right, exactly. There's plenty of things that they could do.
Oh my God, I want this movie now!
Now, is Tobey Maguire too old to do this?
I guess if he is, you play with that. You run into it. Yeah,
they can play it. But I also... Oh God. I also... That scene is terrible.
It's awful.
Did Sam Raimi ever apologize for that?
No, he didn't.
But well, isn't here, it like it's a...
He just stopped making them.
He just stopped making movies.
Well, here is that was the interesting apology. Thing. Here's the interesting thing, but this is unfortunate the way that these movies fall. Sam Raimi is directing Doctor Strange into the Multiverse.
Amazing.
Doctor Strange in the Multiverse.
Is there any way that like they'd give him back the multiverse? They'd bring him back to Spider-Man?
Or that's the movie that... Okay, so... Here you go. So you have the third Spider-Man movie. You introduce Electro, and he's... bleeding over from the Andrew Garfield world. Andrew Garfield's like, what are you talking about? There's a multiverse. There are other versions of Spider-Man out there. That movie ends. It goes to the Doctor Strange movie. Doctor Strange is going through all the different multiverses, and Sam Raimi brings Tobey Maguire back.
Mm.
And then that feeds into the Sinister Six movie which is due to come out after, where all these villains are now together and Doctor Strange introduces Tobey Maguire to Tom Holland and Andrew Garfield.
How do you get...
That sounds awesome. All right, here's my question then. So if you have different actors playing Spider-Man,
yes,
why wouldn't you have a different actor playing Electro if it's a different universe, if it's the multiverse?
Well, only because, like, there theoretically, yes, there would be other Electros out there. There could be an Electro already in Tom Holland's world, but you're just using that character as someone who comes over from the Andrew Garfield world to at least show that, like, there's a character that can come over, sort of thing.
But can Jamie Foxx's Electro actually have interact with Tom Holland's Spider-Man?
Sure, yeah. If he comes over into Tom Holland's version of the universe.
Because I'm just thinking of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, right? Yeah. There were different, there was a female Spider-Man, there was a multiple different Spider-Man. So I'm just trying to understand how this all works. I mean, it's really, like, Spider-Verse actually did a really good job of making it concise. To a point where I understood it.
Just enough changes with the origin in each of the different universes to make them different. Like in the Spider-Gwen universe, she's the one who gets bit instead of Peter. It's just that slight tweak, you know? So you're like, oh, okay, well, that's the origin story of that universe's Spider-Man kind of thing.
It's basically the equivalent of, like, when you're a kid and you have all these, like, different toys from different series, like, and you play with them all together. Like, you didn't say, like, oh, like, you know, these Ninja Turtles can't play with these Ninja Turtles because they're from two different series. You just kind of, like, played it. Like, that's basically, like, now all the kids that grew up doing that are now doing it cinematically. They're doing it in movies.
So it's could we theoretically see a scene where Tom Holland, Andrew Garfield, and Tobey Maguire team up as three Spider-Mans and fight people?
I think we're going to see that.
Yes.
Like, that would be...
But then again, insane. I also thought we were going to see a scene with Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, and Princess Leia, and we never got that either.
Well, we would have gotten that, yeah.
We might have. Well believe that we would have probably gotten to that
point. Han died in 7. How are we going to do that?
Kill Han in 7.
Oh.
He showed back up in 9.
Yeah, he showed back up in 9. Yeah. They could have done it as a...
Oh, God, I forgot that was a scene.
I love that scene. I love that scene.
I like that he calls him kid.
Hey, yeah. Kid.
I'm with
Jacob. Like, that scene. An astral projection of Han?
That was a Force ghost.
No, I think we all chalk that up to... That's probably a scene that was meant for Carrie that she never got to shoot. Wasn't that the theory?
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
That it was originally going to be his mother, and that was because it was Carrie.
I think that story was going to be very much heavy on Carrie's relationship.
Yeah,
I mean, the only reason he's back is because Carrie's movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it makes sense that it's Han because Han, he killed him. He killed his father.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense if it had been Carrie. Han's not a Jedi.
Yeah.
So it couldn't be a Force ghost.
Let's stop talking about Star Wars.
Can he be a Force? Can Han be a Force ghost?
No. He's not a Jedi.
No, he can't be. You're right.
If Rey can be a Palpatine, then all bets are off. Anybody can be anything. All right. The trailer for the 355 dropped, and this looks like a combination of Bourne and James Bond with some high-profile female actresses. And so I'm going to say this, and I'm probably going to get slammed because I totally understand what they're trying to do. They would like to do a female-driven action franchise, and there's some badass women in it. But the trailer didn't do anything to excite me as a spy action thriller. Like, it kind of looked a little bit generic, and I want to give it points for what it's trying to do with casting, and it has a very diverse ensemble, and, you know, it's putting them through the rigors of you know, what you might see in a spy thriller. It's just nothing grabbed me in terms of saying, like, oh, that's going to really stand out. And the director Sean Levy or someone like that?
It's Simon Kinberg.
Oh, Simon Kinberg. Okay, same thing, interchangeable.
Levy's a good director.
Okay,
I like
see,
Sean Levy.
Maybe it's Kinberg, but
it's,
I just...
Isn't it 355?
It is.
What
is
am
it,
I saying?
And it might 355. Be Levy, not Levy.
355, isn't it? 355?
355.
It's like the 7500 debate. It was like 7500, 7500.
I like all those actresses, and I'm sure that they're going to be entertaining to watch, but that trailer did not do anything to make me say, like when I saw the trailer for Atomic Blonde, I was like, oh, all right, damn, that's going to kick ass. I saw this one, and I thought, like, oh, someone's doing a watered-down spy thriller.
I think they're relying very heavily on, like, don't you want to see all of these actresses together on the screen at one time? Like, you know, I think that the plot itself is a distant afterthought.
I think for me visually, I thought the trailer looked cool. I mean, I didn't, the story particularly didn't grab me. I just was intrigued to see like Lupita and Chastain and everybody together. But Kinberg, I mean, Dark Phoenix was not good. Nope. Nothing Kinberg has done from a directing standpoint, which was just Dark Phoenix and he did a Twilight Zone episode, excites me for that. Now, I think the trailer didn't have a voice on it. It just felt like a trailer for like an action film. Yes. You know what I mean? Like I feel like if this was directed by like, I'm just trying to think of like Michael Bay or whoever, whatever directors are out there.
Mm-hmm. Tim Miller.
Nothing sang for me from like a voice standpoint. Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited to see all these actors together. I think like the action looks really cool. I think there's some cool slow-mo stuff, whatever. But it almost felt like an Ocean's movie.
A little bit
as well. And I think Kinberg needs, Kinberg hasn't excited me yet as a director. And I think I'm not ready yet. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it could be cool. You never know. Chastain is a great actor. She does great projects. She's generally in good films. Like, think about Chastain's record. I mean,
sure.
Everybody from Ridley Scott to Malick to, I mean, it's amazing who she's worked with. So I have to imagine that if it's a script that she read and took it,
and you talk about Dark Phoenix, you know, I really wonder how much Dark Phoenix was out of his hands and how much of that really got screwed over by Marvel and got screwed over by Fox and just with everything that was going on. Because keep in mind, like, that means, like, Jessica Chastain could have had too bad of an experience making that with him. Otherwise, she wouldn't make a second film with him. So I feel that the fact that she's back with him again says that she saw something in their experience together.
Kinberg is a brilliant producer. I mean, the guy's produced some of the biggest movies of all time.
I think she, like, to your point, like, she's worked with enough amazing filmmakers that she would know if the guy had the stuff or not. And
she's
so
wasted
in
Dark Phoenix.
Oh, it's
that
so
character
bad.
Is so nothing.
Yeah.
The character is so nothing. With all due respect to Diane Kruger, though, I see, like, she's the blonde British agent, I believe. Like, how is that not Charlize? Like, don't you have to get Charlize for that role? I just feel like she has to be the one alongside Chastain.
I think the two
Lupita.
Of them charge very different.
Yeah, I guess so. That's right.
Either way, I mean, like, it's one of those things where I think, yes, I'm excited for any new movie. I'll always give it a fair shot. But trailer itself didn't grab me. I'm with you.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it could be great.
All right. Didn't watch this, but Jake, you did. News of the World trailer. Tom Hanks, Paul Greengrass. Tell us all about it.
It looks fantastic. Really looks like basically Tom Hanks has to get this young girl from A to B, like through like the Old West. And along the way are people that don't want them to get there or want to intervene or want this young girl.
Okay.
And I mean, Greengrass doing Old West, Tom Hanks doing Old West in like an old school, like protective role. I was trying to wreck my brain. Like, Tom Hanks hasn't really done Old West or done this genre, has he? And granted, yes, the role itself is of a like kind, fatherly, protective person, which Hanks nails.
Yeah.
But it also feels different because we've never really seen him in that environment. He's got the beard, he's got the hat. At one point he does refer to himself as captain, which I was just sort of like, God, Greengrass has a thing for Tom Hanks' captains. But I'm sold. I mean, I'm either the wrong or the right person to ask about this because I'm behind the eight ball when it comes to, I mean,
does
a prestige picture with Tom Hanks. Though I will say, of the Tom Hanks movies that were going to come out this year, remember this month we were supposed to get the one that I really wanted to see, which is the one about where it's post-apocalyptic.
Oh, the dog.
Yeah, and he's dying and he has a dog, so he is building a robot to take care of his dog.
What happened in that movie?
I got delayed. It got pushed back. Bios, I think it's called.
Yes, right.
Like
right.
That plot, I feel like someone was like, "What's gonna make Jake cry?" Like Tom Hanks about to die, so let's take. So he needs to take care of his dog. Like done in a box.
Does this movie have the Greengrass visual aesthetic?
I saw someone tweet that they said that it did have the Greengrass shaky cam. I did not notice that. I did not know. To me, it doesn't seem like a boring movie, or even to the degree that Captain Phillips was.
Yeah.
And granted, maybe I was too focused on like, oh my God, it's a Tom Hanks movie. I just watched it once, but it's a quick trailer. It's only like maybe a hair over 60 seconds.
So it's based on a book?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't know. I'm looking at it right now. I didn't know that either. I don't want to pretend like I know that information.
But I did not. It didn't particularly stand out to me that it was like super shaky cam.
But we think this is coming to theaters, or is it a streamer? Is it Apple?
No, it's Universal.
Oh, it's Universal. Okay.
Yeah. I think. Oh, you know, Sean, I think you mentioned this earlier. Remember,
Universal AMC has this deal with Universal where they are okay with their movies going to paid VOD as long as they give them some theatrical like window.
17 days or something? Is it 14 or 17 days?
17.
Okay. Something like that, yeah. I'm seeing here that it's scheduled for release on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right now it is, yeah.
But you know how it goes. Well, that could be
that's traditional awards consideration, but awards consideration goes into February now at this point.
And one of the things I talked about in our text thread, which is that, like, at the end of the day, this is a very thin Oscar year.
Oh, my gosh.
And there have to be studios looking at this going, like, I don't think Tenet was beloved enough to be. No, I don't think it's going to be your Oscar darling, brother. I don't.
I know.
Well, I think it could be. Maybe it could be Fincher's year. But I think studios kind of have to start looking and going like, hey, like maybe this is our chance to win an Oscar. Like maybe this is our chance to like. I mean, like with a competition pool that shallow.
Okay, so does a win this year have an asterisk alongside of it, like the Astros when they won the World Series?
Didn't we have a whole argument about this at one point on the show about like the Oscar changes and like the, cause wait, so the,
I'm sure
the new deal now is this, right? Like anything that was put to streaming that was originally.
Oh, even their logo kind of looks like an asterisk. Yeah. I never noticed that.
Oh yeah.
It's like an asterisk. Pretty appropriate. Like a star.
It's pretty appropriate.
I actually didn't notice that either until just now.
You guys know that we've won 4 playoff games in a row, right? Like you guys know that we're one winner away from going from the, to the, American League Championship Series.
Anybody check the trash cans?
I hate this fucking show.
So anyway, this Oscar race is going to be fascinating for various reasons. I'm sure they're going to be very qualified films that we're going to be seeing in the next few weeks and months that will qualify. But something about the entire thing is going to be feeling really weird. So you're going to want to keep it locked here onto Ribland for
impossible question.
Our conversation.
Impossible question. Jake, you're going to hate me, but I'm going to ask it. If the Oscars happened tomorrow, what would win from this year right now?
Oh, that's a good question.
And Trial of the Chicago 7 does count because it was released on October or in theaters in September 30th.
What wins Best Picture? What would win Best Picture right now?
I think enough people at least, I mean, knowing how like voting works, I think enough people like Chicago 7 for that to be Best Picture right now.
Yeah,
if I was predicting the Oscars, I would predict that.
I mean, it's not really divisive. Like everyone exists somewhere between liking it and loving it. Right. It's reflective of what is going on today, which Oscar loves.
What about Defy Bloods? Chadwick,
I feel like
Spike
Defy
Lee.
Bloods has cooled down.
Yes. I feel that.
I think
too.
They're gonna ramp back up Delroy though. But do you sense an urgency for Trial, though? I don't feel Trial buzz.
Not yet.
I think because not enough people have seen it.
I sense a lot of heat around One Night in Miami.
Yes, yeah. Buzz.
But, I mean, but aside
like,
from like the a few people out of the festivals, like people haven't really seen it,
yes.
right?
Yes, but that feels good, like the movie that we need to see right now. Yeah. All right. Gabe is reminding us that we can pick this up in a larger discussion in the coming weeks because, yes, we started this show as Awards Blend. It's something that we all love talking about, and this is going to be an unusual award season to track. So make sure you're here every single week to get our feedback on how we feel about how things are going.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering. So you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms? My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
This week in movies, opening theatrically, October 9th, as we discussed earlier, The War with Grandpa. Who saw The War with Grandpa? I know you guys did interviews. Jake, how is it?
It's one of the worst movies I've seen in a long time. I mean, you know, we use this expression a lot. No. Like, I often think like joking, but like, I genuinely felt bad for Robert De Niro. I mean, and also, like, here's sort of my big issue, and maybe this is just me, like, getting old and turning curmudgeon-y, but the premise of the movie, I just have a really big problem with, and I could not get over it enough to at least turn off my mind and enjoy the movie, which is basically, like, an older gentleman, Robert De Niro, his wife passes away, he's alone in his house, having a tough time, like, going out and shopping and doing stuff on his own. So his kids say, like, hey, come live with us. And this little shit of a grandchild of his gets all pissy because they give Robert De Niro his room. So he starts doing really mean things to his grandpa because he's pissed off that he had to give his elderly grandpa,
like brutal things, really nasty stuff.
And it's just like, I'm like, okay, you little asshole. Like, I'm sorry that your father, who lost his wife, who is having a hard time later in life, has to come live with you. But like, get over it. Get over yourself. Like, and so the whole premise is that you're supposed to think it's funny that this little shit of a kid is being mean to his grandpa because like, he took his, it boils down to, you took my room. Like, that's what it, and so, aside from the fact that it's poorly written and poorly acted and has a lot of amazing actors doing really embarrassing things, I could not get over what I thought was just a really mean, nasty premise.
And Jake brings up an interesting point because you have to buy into it. Like with Home Alone, for example, when Macaulay Culkin tortures Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern.
Yeah, but those are like, those are bad guys. Yeah, but they're criminals. They're trying to break into his home.
Right, and you're rooting for it. It's like fun to watch. Like basically, if you imagine like what Macaulay Culkin was doing to Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, but a kid doing it to his grandpa for taking his room for a little bit.
Yeah,
that's what you have to understand. And I think Jake does bring up a good point. It's hard to kind of cross that barrier because you're like, why would you like? There's one point where doesn't he screw out the screws of the bed and he like gets in the bed and he falls and I'm like, how much work is it going to be to put that bed back together?
Yeah. Well, not just that. At one point, he like spills marbles all over the place and like De Niro slips and like falls on the ground on the marbles. It's just like, you could have you could have like killed your grandfather. Like,
did De Niro do his own stunts, do you think?
You bet he does.
I am thankful for the marbles scene only because it led to a
great question.
Yeah. Well, because I ended up asking because Jake and I did the junket for it and, there's something surreal, and Jake can attest to this too. When you pop up in the middle of Robert De Niro's living room, and he's like sitting in front of his fireplace, and you're seeing what's on his mantle, and it's like,
I tried to do like a decipher of like, what the hell you got on your mantle?
Oh, I've been breaking it all. There's like, I'm looking at it, and like,
I try to do like a CSI thing, like enhance. Enhance.
Yeah. Even though he was with like the two kids from the film, we're still in Robert De Niro's home. Yeah, but he battled on them. But at one point, I just brought up this question about the marbles in the film because basically the marbles it's tied to this bit where like every house that he built, his character built, he saved a marble for each house or whatever. So I just asked him like, listen, Mr. De Niro, I'm technically virtually in your home right now. Do you have any of your, you know, movie props and stuff like that? And he was like, he started telling me that all of his props are at University of Texas, which I didn't know. I didn't have time to follow up, but
he's
like,
they have an extensive library there.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and then he starts telling me this random story about when he was he just nonchalantly said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was as if it was me saying, hey Jake, how you doing today? He goes, yeah, they handed me these boots from Bonnie and Clyde so I could use them in Godfather Part 2. Like, you just dropped two of the most classic, insane films. I mean, he said Godfather 2 as if it was just a normal breath for him.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It was,
well, it
like,
is to him.
Yeah. For him, it's just a thing he was in.
Another day on the job.
But to hear him say that in his living room while talking to me and through my computer screen, That was
it's
cool.
Like, it's like us talking about Real Blind episodes. It's not too. It's no different.
Yeah. Good point.
The War with Grandpa story reminds me of a personal recollection. When I first realized how much power we had as mischievous kids, it was New Year's Eve, and I'm trying to guess how old I was. I might have been like third or fourth grade, and my older cousin would have been like fifth or sixth grade. He's a few years older than we are. And my grandpa moved in with us and lived in our house after he was in an accident. He was getting off of a train and his leg got caught between the train and the platform.
Oh my God.
And broke so badly that he wasn't, he basically was immobile. So he moved in with us and moved downstairs, which sounds very similar to the War with Grandpa premise. However, I wasn't always mean to my grandpa, but on New Year's Eve, he agreed to babysit us so that our parents were able to go out, my aunt and uncle and my mom and dad. And we snuck downstairs at my cousin's urging, and we got pots and metallic spoons. And at midnight, we were planning on banging them together, making a lot of noise. So we did. We opened up all the windows in my bedroom, and at midnight, we started clanking everything together. And my grandfather was probably fast asleep and got up from his chair and had to, like, drag himself over to the bottom of the stairs with his bad leg and scream up the stairs, like, "Stop making all that noise! What are you two doing?" And we stopped. And my cousin, I'll never forget this ever. I can visualize it right now. He turned to me and he goes, "He can't come up the stairs. Keep going." And we did. We just kept banging all the stuff together. Jeez. And I still feel horrible about it. But it was true. He couldn't come up and stop us.
And then your grandfather forced you to watch Forrest Gump the next day.
Yes, he did.
And that's why you hate it. Full circle. There we go.
All right. Hubie Halloween. So this movie, I will say, is a lot funnier than I expected it to be. Sandler's Netflix movies have not set a great precedent. They have been largely really lazy and just excuses for him to get together with his friends and do whatever they want to do. And again, I can't besmirch him. We just had a long conversation on Cinema Blend for a video that we did for the YouTube channel about why critics give Adam Sandler so much guff. And we got along the idea of that you tend to want to champion sophisticated comedy and that Sandler is very happy to go for the lowest lowbrow comedy. And Hubie Halloween is absolutely loaded with the lowest of lowbrow comedy. I mean, there's a scene very early on where kids try to throw eggs at him as he's riding his bike along. That's right. And
they, he catches them.
First they miss him. And he says, "You missed. Yolk's on you." And it's like, that's even bad for Real Blend, right? Like, that shouldn't be on this podcast.
I think that fits into Real Blend perfectly.
I'm sorry, that
so
makes
then the
me
next
laugh.
Few kids throw eggs at him, and he miraculously catches them in this thermos that he carries around with him, catches them all. And then he goes, "Thanks for breakfast." And he chugs the eggs and he goes, "Rocky Balboa style." And then he projectile vomits
He's
riding the bike. He projectile vomits, but it's so comically overdone. You could see like the hose behind him just like streaming vomit out. And all of this is happening. And I'm like, what is this movie? What is going on?
You guys are really selling it.
But I had to admire the fact that it just leaned into the stupidity of it all. Like, it's just him doing another character with just a weird voice. He's an immature man-child who lives at home with his mom, like he does in every other Adam Sandler movie.
It's like Waterboy.
He has a gorgeous love interest, because whenever Adam Sandler puts the template together, he gets a gorgeous love interest. In this case, it's Julie Bowen, who's back from
Happy Gilmore.
Yeah. But there are so many jokes throughout it that are just from the Happy Gilmore universe. Some of them just blatant characters who return, some of them sort of offbeat references to it. And so I'd be lying if I said to you I did not laugh hard multiple times throughout this movie. And so for that reason, I can absolutely recommend it. If you've ever liked any of Adam Sandler's comedies, this one works better than the rest of them do.
Yeah, and we were talking about this earlier, Sean. It's like, and again, it's weird because, like, we're not saying this is a great movie.
No.
It just made us laugh. Like, and again, that could be a product of what's happening in the world right now. It was just like, you know, you watch something. Again, that's why I feel like every time you review a film, I think Kim Holcomb, one of our, person who does interviews in Seattle, she's a really great friend of ours.
Yeah.
She sometimes told me that she would tell people what her mindset was prior going into a movie. And like Hubie Halloween, I think I just threw it on expecting it to not be good. And, you know, you get off Twitter and whatever political stuff is going on in the country and the world or whatever. And again, not making an excuse for it, but the movie somehow hit me in a spot and made me laugh. I mean, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? I mean, Sean, I mean, I feel like you and I had the same experience. We're like, you know, you sent me a video of a fart scene. It made me laugh, man.
What's crazy is Sean sent us that video and I laughed thinking about Kevin watching that scene. I didn't laugh at the scene. I just pictured Kevin doing that where he throws his head back, where he does I just pictured Kevin laughing.
So I wanted to rewind and video the vomiting scene because just to give you an idea of what
it's
the
one
movie
shot.
Is about.
I gotta be honest, dude. Like vomit does not make me laugh. Like the opening scene of Pitch Perfect. It does not make me laugh.
The joke itself is not funny. It's more funny that someone would even think to put it in a movie. Like, you kind of laugh thinking, like, really? Like, we're doing this kind of thing? But,
like, June Squibb is wearing the craziest shirts.
See, that's a funny bit.
That was every scene she's in. She's her? Wearing something incredibly raunchy.
She shows
on
up
her
in
short.
A scene with a shirt that says, "I shaved my balls for this," and it's just really funny.
Well, here's what's brilliant about Sandler's movies. I rewatched Gilmore and Big Daddy, and I feel like what's brilliant about Sandler's movies, and again, I'm not saying Hubie Halloween's brilliant, but what works about his movies for me are his side characters are really funny. Like the little characters. Remember,
I agree with
about
that.
Think about the caddy in Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Shooter McGavin's funny. But even like it's the little characters. Even the television hosts in Hubie Halloween are funny. Like there's like these little bits. Like I feel like, again, I'm not saying this is like Citizen Kane writing, but I do feel like there's something funny about the fact that he pays attention to all the little details of every little character. So if June Squibb's just walking around a scene wearing a shirt that says what Sean just said, they might not even point it out. It's just there. Mm. And I don't know. I found it funny.
Did you say that characters from Happy Gilmore show up or actors from Happy Gilmore show up?
Both. I'll say
I really want
to
know who.
Well, it's Wednesday now. Do you want me to say?
Yeah.
I mean, I won't say.
Just text me.
Here's all I will say. If you're a fan of Happy Gilmore, don't miss the opening of the film.
Yeah.
That's fun. I like that.
That was cool.
I have a before we move on, I have one more question about reviews.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And this is like 7 days late, but Kevin, since it's October 7th, what's your review on the first season of Lost?
I was waiting for this. You know what? It's so funny. I actually practiced this in front of the mirror the other day. No, I'm kidding.
Wait, is that the date that we? That
no,
we
no, no,
no, no. October 1st was the date.
Six days ago.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, I have not watched it.
Have you watched it anymore?
No, I have not watched any more. I am a bad friend. I'm sorry. I won't go into specific details. I don't really have an excuse other than.
I got to watch the finale of Better Call Saul with Sean. So
that's true. You win. Scenario. You win.
In Jake's defense, I gotta admit my failure here.
Can I give you till December 31st? Can I give you to the end of 2020?
Jake, would it make you feel any better that I do wake up three or four times a week and I do feel like, oh wait, when's Jake gonna ask me if I watched Lost yet? And I feel like guilty as hell about it, but I was waiting for this to come up on the show.
Yeah, that makes me feel a little bit better.
In Kevin's defense, everything's been pushed back this year.
True.
So I feel like he should get more time.
In all honesty,
that makes no sense whatsoever.
No,
you're saying because he has less to watch, he needs more time to watch it?
No, I'm saying that his deadline to reach Lost should have been moved back like everything else has been moved back.
If you go a month back or 2 months back, we had this exact same conversation where I didn't complete the task the first time. This is the second time Jake is giving me the access to go longer.
I'm going to be on my deathbed and I'm going to be like, Kevin,
watch Lost.
Well, the thing is, not even finish Lost. Finish the first season.
Well, I'm going to argue that means it didn't hook him, though.
No, you know what? You know what really
made me feel
bad? You know
what didn't hook me? This show. But I'm still here 140 episodes later.
True.
Jake, you know what made me feel bad, though? There was a day a couple weeks ago, I think it was the 10th anniversary of the finale, or was it the 10th anniversary of the show? It was like some Lost anniversary.
Lost fans celebrate every anniversary of every single episode.
I kept thinking to myself,
it's exhausting.
Jake, please don't hate me. Please don't hate me.
There have been moments where, yeah, it was like the anniversary of the finale and I was going to tweet out something, but I'm so nervous that you're going to see something. Like, I am refraining from celebrating my show out of fear of, I mean, you know our buddy Chase.
Yes.
His social media handles are The Constant, which, if you're a Lost fan, is a massive Lost reference that you will appreciate when you get to that episode in about 84 years.
Last episode I watched was the numbers.
Ooh, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 20, was,
that'd be a cool tattoo to get, by the way.
That'd be a great tattoo.
That'd be a cool tattoo. Alright, you know what? I need to watch it. And I know my word doesn't mean anything now because I've already said twice, Jake, I'm going to watch it. Okay. No, but Jake is right. I should have watched it and I need to watch it. And I'm sorry that I haven't watched it. Right, I am sorry.
Two more movies that are coming out. The Books of Blood is coming to Hulu on October 7th. Anyone seen Books of Blood? Jake has been mainlining.
I saw Books of Blood four times instead of watching Lost.
And Charm City Kings is another film that's been making the rounds on the film festival circuit. It's a Baltimore film.
Lauren covered it the other day. I don't know much about it, but it is. Yeah, you're right. It's a Baltimore-based film. Yeah. Lauren did the junket for it the other day. By the way, speaking of movie theaters, Lauren's actually hosting a screening tonight. In a theater.
What?
Two Hearts, I think, is the name of the
movie. Oh, yeah. I've heard of that.
With Jacob, whatever the guy's name is from The Kissing
Battle
Booth. Alardi.
He was in it, but he got cut out.
But going back to our discussion earlier, they're still doing stuff. Like, when Lauren told me that the studio came to her and they were like, we want you to host a screening, I'm like, that's still insane. Pushing promo screenings. So,
Jake, talk briefly about The Haunting of Bly Manor, which opens on Netflix on Friday and is bingeable. It's every episode drops, right?
Yeah, it's 9 episodes down, 1 from last season, which was 10.
Okay. Not too specific because we want to really wait to talk about it until more people have had a chance to see it. But you did the interviews, so.
Look, I'll tell you this. You know, I think Sean and I both agree, and I think Kevin does too, that the first season, Haunting of Hill House, is not just great television. It's like one of the greatest pieces of horror art or honestly just pop culture I have seen.
It's one of the best
in my life. Yeah, like just phenomenal. masterful television.
Yep.
So to complain that it doesn't reach those heights, I think is a little unfair.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it. I mean, it's much more of a slow burn gothic horror story, which is just personally not as appealing. I think sort of not to get too specifics, my biggest complaint I would just say is that it is based on Bly Manor, which is Turn of the Screw. And Turn of the Screw has been adapted like 35, 40 times. Whether you know it or not, there's a good chance you've seen many adaptations of Turn of the Screw. Mm-hmm. And so while they do take that story and go a lot of different unique directions with it, this season just felt a lot more familiar. It was grounded in a certain level of familiarity than Hill House was, and I think that's to a certain degree. Like there were big twists that came in the latter half of the season that I called simply by nature of being familiar with the source material, okay. And I feel like that's going to be the case. But like I said, I don't want to like call out the things that Turn of the Screw has been turned into, because then you might realize what some of the twists are that are coming.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling
I'm not that familiar, or I don't think I am familiar.
I think you are.
Oh, really?
And I think that I think you're going to be able to call a lot of the twists. You know, it's good. You know, and it's. But here's what I'll say: is that if I were to give Hill House a glowing 10 out of 10, then I would give Bly Manor a solid 7 out of 10.
Okay.
Yeah, and I watched the first episode, and just from a purely directing standpoint, Flanagan directed that episode. There are two split diopter shots in that episode that blew my mind. Like they're just look if you're a fan.
That's
of
the only episode that he does though in the season.
Split diopter shots, by the way, were very, very famously, you know, they've been made for years, but Blowout was probably the most the best example of what those shots were. But Flanagan sticks a couple of them in the first episode. There's one in particular where Victoria Pedretti is like, you know, her face is up forefront, and then the daughter's room is behind her, but it looks closer. That's what a split diopter is. It's awesome. I think visually the show looks incredible. I've only seen episode
beautiful.
One.
It's beautifully made.
Yeah, and I think Henry Thomas is very good in it. Pedretti's great in it. I mean, so far from what I've seen, that's the thing. It's like this is a hard question to answer. I think it's impossible to even answer it. But if we hadn't seen Hill House. Mm. how would we approach this?
I've seen all nine. I've seen the whole season at this point. I went into it knowing it probably wasn't going to match Hill House.
Mm-hmm. I think I was expecting that level of quality. And again, that's just personal. We all go in with personal.
Sure. Flanagan's coming off that Dr. Sleep, too, which was incredible, too. Yeah. So, yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think Flanagan just, you know, he had a lot of like behind the scenes involvement, but he wasn't directly involved. Like he only directed the first episode. That's it.
Do you remember in our interview, he said like he was like, yeah, I told the directors to stay away from like long takes. And
episode six. And if you watch the first season, you know what I mean? Like there's no long there. You know, there's no like one episode that everyone's going to be talking about.
You know, I just want a good story.
Sure. So.
But it feels like less Flanagan involvement, I think is what Jake's saying. Okay. I think Hill House felt like Flanagan was in every episode.
Sure.
And I haven't seen the rest of the season, but it just sounds to me, especially since he only directed the first episode, that he just kind of like not handed things off, but I'm sure he trusted the directors. And
And there's just I mean, you remember when the first season was over, like everyone was still was talking about like that scene in the car in episode eight or like episodes. All you had to do was say episode six. Yeah. There's not that like there's not that moment that like I can't wait for you guys to see.
All right, we'll discuss it in more detail as more people are able to see it, which brings us to our blend game. And for October, we're maintaining a horror theme on the show, and we're doing Haunted House Blend. Hashtag Haunted House Blend for this week's episode. We have some really great suggestions from everybody else, which we'll get to in a minute. Kev, I'm going to start with you. What was your pick? You said you were down to two.
Yeah, I was down to two, but I feel like, I mean, I feel like The Shining is like the one that I had the hard time not choosing because, in my opinion, every single inch of that place is terrifying. And I think the way Kubrick created that environment, created that immersion, created that space, I never felt safe in there. And I think a lot of that has to do with just, again, great storytelling, great performances. But when the actual object of the house or whatever you want to call it, the hotel, I'm assuming Shining fits into this.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, I think so. Okay. Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. I could nitpick, I guess. It's not a house per se, but I won't do that.
All right. Well, I'll go with
the spirit of it is it's your,
I would give you, this isn't a T-1000. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, every room in the Shining hotel is haunted essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And they live there.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's what made that movie so terrifying is when like the hotel became a character, right? Yeah. The hotel was a character itself. It wasn't
the hotel is the villain.
Villain, right? It was, but it wasn't just like, you know. And again, haunted house, I find interesting because like some of my biggest pet peeves in horror films these days are when they use haunted house jump scares that have no emotion attached to them whatsoever. And with The Shining, it was. Every moment felt unnerving. It would the entire film.
The score, the
like
opening
that.
Score.
Yeah. It is so disturbing. And obviously the use of the house, right? If you think about the way they use room 237 or clearly the elevator sequence or, you know, everything about that hotel or and or house was part of the horror. I mean, you don't have a axe scene without a door inside of a hotel. You don't have the bathroom, whatever you have. So I think to me, even what do you call the area where they go below and fix the pipes and stuff?
Furnace,
whatever.
Yeah, basement.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that terrifying shot where like they, is it, I'm trying to remember, they end up, they're out in the snow and then they end up back in the furnace. Like at one point, I'm trying to remember the shot specifically. It might be another film I'm thinking of, but either way. But I genuinely think that it has to be the classic one. Because even you watch Ready Player One, right? And once you get dropped into the hotel in that scene, I felt the horror again.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing that gigantic wide shot with the typewriter and the staircase brought me so much anxiety. You know, and I think this is what my point is now that I'm thinking about it. The house, the area that that film takes place in is so ingrainedly scared in my mind that I immediately went back to the nerves in my stomach when I saw Spielberg recreate it in a digital way or whatever, how he did it in Ready Player
One. Or even
One.
when Ewan McGregor like pulled up to it at the end of Dr. Sleep, when he pulls up and he says like, I've got to wake it up. I mean, you don't say I've got to wake it up to a normal, you say I've got to wake it up to like a monster.
What
like
do you think Gabe said to it when he pulled up to the actual sets of the Overlook
I can't
house?
Wait to talk about this on Real Blend in 3 years.
But, you know, no, you make hallways scary.
Yeah.
You make doors scary.
Yeah.
A door is scary. A hallway. I mean, like, it's and again, the genius of what Kubrick did, those flashes of violent images and things like that. But to me, The Shining, it's crazy because think about the end of Dr. Sleep. He burns the hotel down. Like he kills the monster. Like Jake said, it's the villain. And I think that at the end of the day, I can't think of a better example of a use of space that was created such an unnerving element in me. And then and on top of that, once you have your actors acting with that material, then you have perfection. That I think The Shining is the scariest film I have ever seen in my life. I can't think of anything more terrifying than that film that I've seen yet.
Jakey, personally. What's your choice?
Mine's going to piss you off.
Oh.
Because I'm cheating and I'm saying The Haunting of Hill House.
Okay. Why is that?
No, that's fair.
Because it's a TV show.
That's fair. That's
okay. I think it is.
That's fine.
Such a beautiful creation. I mean, obviously they have 10 hours, so we're able to really invest in these characters, but I can honestly tell you it's the only time I have finished a haunted house story and been weeping. I mean, there have been, yeah. I mean, it not only did it feature some of the like most scared, like jump scares I've ever experienced in my life, not just her coming out of the back of the car, but the first time that the bent neck, just saying bent neck lady, just sort of sends
the bent neck
shivers.
Lady is one of the most inventive horror characters of the past 20 years.
But the brilliance, and here's what escalates Hill House from being like a 10 out of 10 to being one of the greatest things I've ever seen, which is the bent neck lady is a terrifying creature, horrible monster, whatever you want to call it, in and of itself. But then when you understand her, when you understand who she is, do you understand that's when you just go, well, this is genius.
And how often do you find out the backstory of the scariest creature and it makes you sympathize with it?
Yes.
Like, never.
Because often the backstory makes you go, oh, that's, I didn't want to know that. That kind of ruins it.
Exactly.
Like this makes it better.
Yes.
And I
but
just,
don't,
I
give
mean,
it, don't say what it is.
Yeah.
Just
yeah
for,
if you,
in
if
case
you haven't seen
it,
but it's, I mean, everything, just the visualization, just on a technical level, a storytelling level. And just by the end, I was genuinely weeping. Like, I just thought it was just a beautiful, beautiful piece of art. One of the greatest single seasons of television I've ever seen. One of the greatest pieces of horror I've ever seen. And I think it will probably, for the rest of my life, be, like, my favorite haunted house tale.
It also
and
really Jake's, does Jake... very simple things in terms of, like, a dumbwaiter. You know, like, you put a kid in a dumbwaiter.
Yeah.
He goes down to the basement. You can't get him back
using
up.
Using the space.
Just simple things.
Yeah. Using
simple
the space. Like to that. Your point, Kevin, one of the things I talked to the stars in Flanagan about is this thing that they do where they hide ghosts in corners.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the most unsettling things. When you're casually watching a show... And this is really before people start talking about it. When you're casually watching a show and then you look in the corner and you kind of lean forward and you go, is that like a fucking person in the corner? Like, and they hide. And I only caught probably 10%. There's a great website that I think captured most of them where you take screenshots. Throughout the series, they hide ghosts in corners. And it's the most unsettling thing to be casually watching a show and realize that there's someone in the corner the entire time.
I think James Wan does that really well, too. I think James Wan does it in his Conjuring films.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, but and that's the thing about
effective.
The Conjuring movies. They use the house really well.
For
like,
sure.
I mean, like, that. There is, like, your...
Conjuring
would
have been a good...
Hill House and Shining don't work without the space.
Sure,
I mean, like, and
space is a
director,
great idea.
Yeah, you gotta use... And, like, Hill House... I still have in my mind ingrained that area where the staircase is. I can see it in my head because
it's tangible.
It terrified me. Right. And I think when it goes into playing haunted house blend, I think a lot of it from my perspective comes from how a director uses space, how a director uses the location as, you know, it was a great house movie, I guess, but it's not horror movie, Knives Out. That was a movie that used a house used space well.
Yeah.
Again, not to our point.
But also, like, to sort of flip that on the edge, like one of the things Flanagan was talking about with Kubrick in our interview with him is how disorienting the geography of the Overlook is. And whether it be on purpose or whether it just be because Kubrick said, I don't care, it doesn't need to make sense. Like,
I think it's
like
on purpose.
The disorientation... The fact that it doesn't really make logical sense in our brains, I think makes it so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like that I don't really understand where the front door of the Overlook Hotel is.
You are experiencing the disorientation the characters are.
Yes.
Anytime Like, and again, I go to Tenet, for example. As we go through Tenet, we are the protagonist. We are going through the story as that character, and it's very important that we have that experience. That right there is true immersion. And to Jake's point, and Stanley Kubrick creating a disorientation, if you are confused in a good way, just like the characters are, you're then them.
Oh, God, now I'm gonna watch The Shining tonight.
I mean, The Shining is.
Sean, what did you?
Yeah, I forgot to mention to Henry Thomas about the. Oh, his amazing performance as Nicholson's character.
Oh, yeah, he did such a good job.
God, it was awesome.
All right, I went with the Amityville Horror. And I went with...
The original?
No, I went with the Ryan Reynolds version. Yes,
really?
I went with the Ryan Reynolds version.
You know, I've only seen it one time.
For this reason. The original is one of those films where I'm sure it was very, very scary in its time, but it's super dated. Like, if you go back and rewatch it now, it's just not that... It's just filled with, bad sort of 70s... tech that can't really conjure scare, and the actors, Margot Kidder's totally overdoing it. James Brolin's not really that dialed into it. But the reason why I love the Amityville Horror story is because that happened in the town right next door to where I grew up.
What?
Massapequa, Long Island is literally
right, so that's
right
like
next
a
door.
legit. Not like a Texas Chainsaw where they say it was a true story and it wasn't a true story. Like,
no.
Amityville was
so
an actual...
growing up, you could actually drive to the Amityville Horror House.
Does it look like it does in the movie?
Identical to how it looks in the movie. It looks identical.
I did not
know
this.
It's on Long Island, right?
It's on Long Island,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. That's
so
cool. I didn't know that.
Amityville is right next door to my hometown. And so one of the things you did as a teenager, once you got your driver's license, was work up the nerve in the middle of the night to drive by the Amityville Horror House. And it looks identical to the way that it does. And if you remember the structure of the house, it has those windows up at the top that
look like eyes.
They look like eyes. And
does anyone live there?
Yes. People live there now.
Why would you live there?
But going to see that house for the first time as a teenager was one of the very first times that what I saw in a movie was real. Like a scary movie. And, you know, you talk about all these locations, like you're never going to see the Overlook unless you're Gabe, who gets to be the luckiest man on earth and go see the Overlook.
Exactly.
But I got to drive to that house and see the house, and there it was. And so I had the Amityville Horror book. There's a book on which it's based. That's a true life story about what happened with that family. And that's one of those really good haunted house movies, I think, where you're never 100% certain is the movie haunted or are the people in it going crazy, right? Like, are they losing their minds and projecting
like
all the different stuff? The Shining is very similar to that, yes, too. So I thought the Ryan Reynolds one was a really good update of the Amityville Horror story of just like a guy who's trying to be a good dad, trying to be a good husband, but thinks he's slowly losing his mind. And people don't use Ryan Reynolds that way. I thought it was pretty effective, but I will never be able to get beyond the image of the house and the eyes and the way that the house seems to be lighting up with terror. And in the 70s, I forget if the Ryan Reynolds version used flies the way that the 70s version used flies. Like, flies were everywhere. They were an important part of, and I can remember reading the book for the Amityville Horror, and they had flies on scattered pages. They would just have drawings of flies because whenever the flies turned around or showed up, that meant that the evil presence that was affecting the people in the house, that was the way that they sort of showed themselves. And so I'm choosing that because I can remember to this day, like driving to go see the actual house and realizing, and it's on a suburban street. It's fairly generic. And it did get to the point over the years where they had to almost block the street because too many people were just using it as a drive-by. It did have a cul-de-sac at the end of it, so you would just basically wait in line, and you'd go all the way down, and you'd check out the house, and then you'd turn around and come back out kind of thing. But, terrifying. Wow. So I'm picking Amityville.
I also, sorry, just want to shout out that Ryan Reynolds is excellent in that movie.
He's great.
I do remember him
being
good.
And that was in that weird era where, like, it was post-Van Wilder, and he's obviously super funny and very attractive, and I don't know if people really knew how to use him sort of era before Green Lantern and stuff happened, and I think he did a lot of films like that where it was like, this guy's good.
Who was
this
the girl
really
in that, too? She had a career for a hot second. Melissa something? She's a blonde girl who I thought was on TV and was about to... I think she was an Alias and was about to sort of break out, but then never did anything. All
Melissa
right,
George?
Melissa George. Melissa George, yes.
I love Van Wilder, by the way.
Yes, I know you do.
I love
that
movie.
And Just Friends. That's another really good one, too.
Just Friends is amazing.
Yeah, it's terrific.
That's, You know, that's a great movie.
We should do
that's
Ryan Reynolds movie. Blend one day.
Yeah.
Have we not? Sounds like one that we should do.
We've done Reynolds Blend.
Michelle Garrest, Lawrence Weinstein, and several others went with Poltergeist, which Kevin was watching the other day.
By the way,
yeah,
I'm going to say one thing about that. Poltergeist is on Netflix. It has arguably one of the most disgusting, violent scenes I've ever seen in a film, and it is PG.
Yes.
And this is before the PG-13. Hey,
parental guidance was suggested.
Like, right before the PG-13, though. Right
before. My favorite thing was, because Jake is like the horror aficionado. He goes, what the heck movie is that?
It's been so long since I've seen Poltergeist. I didn't realize that was the Poltergeist scene. Yeah.
There's a scene, and I'll tell it to the audience, there's a guy in front of a mirror, and he rips his face off very slowly, and it's PG, and I do not understand how
it's super graphic. Thank you for sharing that with us. John Palmer and many others went with The Shining. Rokan Alzeer says The Conjuring. And Danny Gurch said The Others, also a really good one. Yes, Jake.
I'm just thinking about the fact that within the last, let's call it 7 days, the three of us have recorded videos of movie scenes and sent it to each other. Kevin sent a scene of a dude peeling his face off.
Correct.
Yes. I sent a scene from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that shows a camera after a girl blows her brains out, like going through the back of her head and then out of the van, which is a great shot.
Yes.
Sean sends a video of Adam Sandler farting.
Yes.
And I feel like the fact that we all sent just terrifying videos to each other just really sums up the friendship that we had.
Mine was the scariest of them all. That wasn't. For next week, we're going to be playing hashtag zombie movie blend. So you're going to be picking your favorite zombie movie using hashtag zombie movie blend. Let us know your pick using hashtag zombie movie blend on social media. Or you can also email us your pick at realblend@cinemablend.com. That is the website or the email address, sorry, that you can also send reviews to. And this week's review comes to us from Alexi Ross, who calls us the best film podcast out there. Dear Sean, Kevin, Jake, and Gabe, I found your podcast back in March through your first Quentin Tarantino interview, and ever since then, I've been hooked. Listening to you guys chat in a casual and highly knowledgeable manner is so enjoyable and informative, which makes me look forward to every new episode. Your podcast has made me fall in love with movies, and Kevin's adoration of Tarantino prompted me to go and watch all of his movies, many of which are now among my all-time favorites. The friendship and banter between you guys is so great, and I hope you continue doing this for years to come. Thank you for everything. And Dunkirk, best wishes, Alexi. P.S. Kill Bill is one movie, not two.
Yeah, it is. All right,
well, that's a
fat, I like her. What's her name? One more time.
L for me. That is Alexi Ross.
Alexi. Thank you, Alexi Ross. We appreciate you.
Appreciate you, Alexi. For everyone else who would like to send a review, go to the Apple iTunes page and drop one there. Or again, as we mentioned, you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. As soon as we finish this, we're going to be recording our next premium episode. For this one, we're going to be sharing stories about the most scared we have ever been in a movie theater. And the minute that with this topic came up in the text chain, we all had stories that we knew we wanted to tell. So that will be the subject matter for the next premium episode. In the meantime, and if you want to sign up for premium, you can go to what is it again, Gabe?
What's the just go to bit.ly/realblendpremium.
Thank you.
All one word, no capitalization.
Thank you for having my back on that one. And we're up to like 12 episodes now, 13 episodes.
This is number 11, premium? I think, that we're about to put out.
Yeah. There we go. So there's a little archive if you guys want to
yes,
want to
get it. You'll have access to all of them.
Where's my newsletter?
Should I be concerned that I get a bill in the mail every week for $5 from Gabe saying...
That's different.
You did the,
that's
you did a different...
That's your fee to be on the show.
I'm like, what?
Yeah.
He charges me more to be on the show.
It's an appearance fee for me. I'm on it. Right.
You can follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell. Follow the show at Real Blend. Drop us a review on iTunes, and we will be back next week. Until then, Mank!
QB Halloween!
QB Halloween. that's funny.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget.
Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.